following recording is an interview by Ellie Pitkin, director of Blackshaw Theatre Company, with Kat Roberts, writer of Staying Alive, and Nick Whitworth from bereavement charity Slow.
So, can you guys just let me know how you know each other?
We met when I wrote a monologue for one of the Blackshaw New Writing Nights, which was a competition, and won it, yay. afterwards, decided that I should really do a lot more research into the topic. The monologue was from a mother who'd lost her son, and a lot of it was really just what was coming out of my mind from my experiences of grief. But when we wanted to develop it, I thought I should go and do a lot more research into and do some narrative research and find out some stories of people who'd actually had that specific experience happen to them. And so Ellie and the guys at Blackshaw got in touch with a few charities, and Slow and Nick came back to us, and I went to meet her at her house, and we had a chat, didn't we?
We had a sort of wild afternoon, really. It's actually, my memory of it is kind of forever imprinted on my brain, because I think it was a nice day.
It was a lovely day.
And we sat in the garden at the back of our house, and I found Kat just had that wonderful aspect that I think all bereaved parents, mostly I'll speak for myself in this, but I think I can say this for all bereaved parents, that being listened to with a sort of a deeply present person is one of the best things that can happen to me as a bereaved parent. So I think we had quite a few hours together in the garden.
Yeah, I think we were booked in for an hour, and we were there for about 4 hours because we got on too well.
That's right.
It was such a special day, and again, I always really remember it as well. And then we kind of exchanged cards, didn't we, of how we got on, and it was really lovely. Yeah. It's one of these things, I think, when you start writing something, you're trying to look for structure and character and all these technical things, and then when you start doing narrative research, you really get involved in the most important bit, which is what the play is actually about. Mm-hmm. And I think that conversation just reframed everything for me, from going, ooh, Showcase Award winner, better write a good play, to, oh my goodness, this topic is so important, and I think the play could be really important if we get it right, and it might be able to be a forum in which to start a conversation and allow people to talk about bereavement.
Yeah, I found it such an amazing, memorable afternoon, is that I was able to, there's no beginning and end to this, there's a kind of endless thread of conversation that weaves in and out and up and down of life. So grief is a very alive thing that permeates all of life. And so I found with Kat that it was absolutely okay to sort of dip in and out of every aspect of life and how the death of Naomi has impacted and affected me and my family. And it's like entering a different world of awareness and being, and I think Kat somehow was able to enter that world for that afternoon. It's like a parallel universe, and I found that just wonderful to talk into.
It was lovely, and we talked a lot about time, and that was one of the major themes that came out of the play, and parallel universe, and it was like how grief flings you into a different time frame that nobody else can quite get on board with or seems to be aware of, and that time starts to move very slowly for you, and everyone else seems to kind of keep going at a normal
pace. I think it always makes me think of that Dali clock that stretches over the table, that painting. It's a very surreal sensation for me that time both stretches and it expands, and it also contracts and closes. And I think for me, grief just put me in a place where time no longer had a linear quality, but had a sort of stretchy sense of contraction and vertigo, but also of expansion, and where's the limits of my universe now that my child doesn't exist in it with me? And it's just those kind of ideas that are so hard to have in a normal conversation. In small talk, it's kind of impossible, because you can't grasp the enormity of that quality of time that affects you forever, really.
Yeah, and I think one of the most interesting things that came out and did kind of then start to frame how you're going to present these ideas in the play was the juxtaposition of those massive feelings and experiences coupled with, oh, did you go to the shops today? When you bump into someone, or you get invited to dinner and you have to engage in these completely trivial conversations, and how that would make somebody feel.
Well, also, I think there's an element to it that's not just about I'm very much into not separating the world into them and us, really. So it's like, I'm sure that there's a kind of sense in which when someone says to you, how are you? It's kind of not a willful feeling inside that you kind of don't want to answer them. It's much more like, I don't know how to answer that question. It's like, I'm fine, or how long have you got? Again, it's this kind of stretching out feeling, or just a contraction of, I don't know how to answer that question because my world is irrevocably changed. And if I had the words to describe that feeling, I would try. But actually, it's a very indescribable feeling, grief. So in a sort of social situation, I certainly used to just run from them, because as soon as the how are you word came, with the best of intentions, I couldn't figure out how to answer those questions. That's just one area I know that I share with other bereaved parents.
I think often that question is the problem, though, because it's the beginning of all social encounters, isn't it? It's a really British, you know, that's what you say whenever you see anyone. It doesn't matter if you've never met them before or if they're your closest friend. The first thing you say is, hi, how are you?
Yeah.
So it can't be avoided. And yet it feels, well, for me, it feels a lot of the time like no matter how you are, people just want you to say, I'm fine, how are you?
It's interesting you say about the them and us thing and how absolutely right. It's not really about separating people out, but almost how simply by that contraction and that I don't know how to answer, you do almost become isolated, even though, and then you've got people on the other side trying and not knowing and how do I negotiate this? How do I get in and try and see the world?
I think you're right. I think the fear that the death of your child puts inside us all who, you know, are around or have our own children is fearful for everybody. That's what I'm saying. It's a universal theme. It's a universal fear for us all. That parents, the relationship between a parent and child is about vulnerability. The fact that at the end of the day, we cannot protect our child from dying. Anybody's child can die either suddenly, accidentally, after a long illness, at any point as an adult, as a baby, as a child. And that is a fundamental vulnerability. And we all share that. And then when you step over into the other world where it actually happens to you, it becomes very isolating because we want to shun it and push it away just as much as everyone else.
Yeah.
And the world wants to push away and shun it because it's too terrible to think about. And that's what creates this really difficult problem socially, because no one wants to go near it. You know, I mean, I struggled with it, trying to tame it. It's like sort of being thrown to the lions a bit. And how can I nail this? How can I nail this one? It can't elude me, but it does. Because you're living in a different climate all of a sudden.
Yeah, and we've talked about even recently how even since the time I've known you, everything's shifted and keeps shifting and changes. Grief is changing shape for you all the time.
Yeah, this thing about nailing it. I think I was determined to nail it. And in the early days, months, I was kind of quite interested in educating everyone. I think kind of everyone needs to know about this. But it slips through your fingers and the thought I've had a lot about it recently is there's a kind of homelessness about it, and the grief and the love are inseparable and they move around. So I had this thing about I want to land, I don't know where to put it, I don't know where to put it down, I don't know where to put the grief down. And I found a kind of settled place, I thought, okay, I'm getting the hang of this, okay. And then it would kind of settle for a bit and then up sticks and move off to another place. And I was always trying to find, Where can I settle this relationship? Where can I settle this grief? Where can I find a sustaining place with Naomi and myself that's safe? And even for a while, it feels safe, and then something will happen, like it's coming up to her 18th birthday on November the 12th. And I'm thinking, oh, Christ, and it just throws your world into a different shape again. And so I've kind of less attached now to being any kind of expert in my own position anymore. I think I will, living alongside it with other human beings who are prepared to sort of go where angels fear to tread. I kind of think that's the key, and staying present with grief and staying present with people able to sit with you and be with you in your life. After all, you are the person. In one sense, you're not the person you were before. Another sense, you are the person that walks the planet, who always was there.
Yeah.
And your child is going to be your child forever, and it's like how all that kind of hangs together. That's, you know,
it's quite interesting talking about that feeling of being non-linear or trying to find a place to put it down. And I just think that's a really human, that's a sort of such part of the human condition, is trying to line everything up and put it in a box and figure out where you fit. And I think that's what everybody does, and that's why people try to continue this linear timeline, and that again is so isolating, having this thing which keeps changing shape, and you can't kind of go, oh yeah, that happened and then we got on, you know, it's just always there. And it will keep evolving.
And that's something that's in the play and explored in the play a lot, is this idea that the main character, Mary, the bereaved mother, feels like everyone else is trying to make her order her grief and put it in a process and put it into stages. And they've put an expiration date on, you know, you can be hysterical for 2 weeks, then you can be, you know, in a depression for 6 months. And then they try to give an end date to everything and can't deal with the fact that there's no linear time scale for grief. So it makes me wonder, what was the relationship between the conversations that you had together and then the content of the play?
Instrumental the conversation was in especially the structure and how those things came out. That thing of trying to assign a timeline, we spoke a lot, didn't we, about how the first year, and we even spoke about it again yesterday, the first year, and you think, oh, I've got through a year, surely this is going to get better now, and weirdly it gets like about 10 times worse because you're like, oh, I've still got to carry on. But other people are moving along going, well, it has been a year, we did the supporting thing, we did this thing, we've invited you for dinner, we've done this, that, and you're still feeling this way, you're still feeling this way, I think was one thing that people kept saying to you.
The word still was, are you still feeling
that bad?
That bad. And yeah, the word still, I used to kind of zone into the word still and all its connotations of stillness. And I think that, again, I'd like to say, again, sort of linking up people who this has happened to, again, just looking at the big universal web of humanity, is that we want to feel differently too. And, you know, as well as the fear of our friends and family that, God, aren't they feeling better yet? This is just crazy. This is getting ridiculous. I can't do any more. What can I do? I felt that too. I thought, Christ, what am I doing? Aren't I going to feel better yet? What can I do? And it's like the same conversation.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going bonkers. I must be not doing this right. So I do feel it's a lot more universal. That's what I'm feeling these days. It's actually,
it's everybody.
We're speaking from different sides of the stage of a kind of the line.
Yeah.
Where your child doesn't exist anymore. How can they not exist? And how can I find them? And where can I put them in my life now?
Yeah.
And I think everyone's trying to level out that terrible, jagged earthquake that's happened.
And I think with regards to how that kind of related to the play, I think that was kind of instrumental in the formation of the character of Jen, who is the best friend, who is trying and trying and trying, but she's kind of just so keen to go, okay, so now we've done this, and are you better now, is kind of her vibe. And she's always trying to, she's a doer, she always wants something to be happening. And she can't quite get her head around the fact that she needs to take a step back and give Mary some space. So she's always there. And even, I think, in the very opening scene, which takes place just after Mary's son's funeral, there's about 4 attempts that Mary makes to say something about how she's really feeling. And it sounds a little bit funny. She says things like, do you think you can talk to the dead? Which, it sounds strange, but it makes sense to me that somebody might start thinking like that. And in each occasion, Jen completely shuts her off. She just blocks everything she's saying, because in Jen's view, that isn't helpful. That won't be helpful. We need to put this in a box and carry on as soon as humanly possible. So we assign a little bit of time for sadness, and then the best thing to do will be to get on. And I think we've spoken a lot about how you and me feel like we're quite similar in the way that we lean into things and we want to explore them. And I think Jen is a character, and I think there are people out there like that. It's not like she's mean. I think there are people who genuinely want to go, no, for me, the best thing to do would be to move on. But because she hasn't experienced what Mary's experienced, she's almost just kind of going, well, I think this is what I'd do. And going, but without having the
you see, it's the brain change that's the problem. It's because I actually firmly believe now, looking at my own processes, that my brain cognitive processing changed. So the whole thing about problem solving and the way that we're geared to move forward in life to reduce a discrepancy between where we are now and where we want to be. So everything we do tries to solve that horrible chasm of a gap, like where we don't really know what we're doing, we're just vulnerable human beings. So we're trying to close the gap. What do I do with this problem? Well, when your child dies, there's no fixing it because it can't be thought about. You can't think to try and solve it like everything else. Yeah. So somehow you've got to have a different relationship with it. And that's the bit where you move into a different world. This is not, this sounds all very sorted, it's not. This is just me trying to look back over the years, which is 10 years, trying to work out that I realise I kept trying to solve the problem, become a bit of a problem solver.
Well, that's what I mean. Work. If you've got that personality type, how difficult it must be to experience losing a child, but also how difficult it must be to look at somebody else and go, but hold on, how do I fix this for you? Mm. And you can't. And that must be really painful. And I think that's what Jen experiences in their friendship group. And I think a lot of their friends are just kind of trying, just wanting so hard. And again, the nerves and the fear that they get from having someone over to dinner and being like, do we talk about this? Do we not?
Well, that's the thing I think that's really interesting in the way the play is set up, is that some of it is set at dinner parties with her friends, which is how you get this kind of interaction with the grieving person and the non-grieving. So we've worked out that Jen's a fixer, and that's her main impetus for wanting to just sweep it all under the rug. But for lots of other people, it's just not knowing what to say and then deciding it's better not to mention it. Mm. And I've been doing lots of reading around the subject, and a lot of the things that people say is that they just wish people would talk about the person that's died, like mention their name. Yeah. Because it's, you know, people say, oh, how are you? Which is a kind of indirect reference to the bereavement, but then they don't want to ask any follow-up questions because they think, oh, well, it'll upset them if I talk about it. So, or I'll say the wrong thing and then I'll upset them. So it's easier just to say nothing, which actually seems to be, for a lot of people, the worst thing you can do. Yeah. Is to pretend like it never happened.
Well, that's right. And I, just as I'm sitting here, you know, knowing that I'm sitting in my own body, I also know that Naomi is my daughter, and she is just as much my daughter today as she was 18 years ago when she was born. And you know, her name is never off my lips or off out of my mind. It's not that I'm thinking constantly of her, but she's always there. She's an ever-present person, just as my son is. And just as fiercely as parents of children who are living protect their children, I protect, and I think every bereaved person, parent I've met, protects their child. You know, there's kind of no difference in that fierce protection, and you don't kind of want people to dent that that feeling. It's fiercely protective. And my sister said once to me, quite a couple of years after Naomi died, oh, how's Naomi today? How is she? Where is she? And I know a lot of people would be, God, couldn't say that. My sister, she kind of knows me well enough to say that. And I was just like, wanted to hug her and say, thank you so much. Because, yeah, for me, my relationship, I'm trying to work, adjust to it every day and work out where the fuck she is. Where she is. So someone's saying, how is she? You know, her name, Naomi Grace, is just an ever-present living experience.
I remember you telling me that story and that exact line made it into the play.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
At the end.
Were there other things that you spoke about that are almost directly slotted in to the play?
Yeah, after we had that conversation, I just kind of left in a bit of a daze. And one of the things I think I wrote pretty much immediately afterwards was, just as I was leaving, I remember I turned around to you and I was on, you were on the doorstep, and I said, oh, could I just ask you quickly, have you ever had the experience where maybe meeting a stranger is easier than talking to your friends? And you just told this, it was quite a funny story. I mean, it wasn't actually funny, but you made it funny, about a builder that had come in and was taking down a wall in your house. Just sort of started having a funny chat with you about what you're going to do with the room, and it shouldn't be a shrine, should it? Or it should be whatever he was saying to you. You just sort of forgave him all of it because he was just kind of, he was out there just saying it, exactly what he thought.
Being innocently irreverent.
Yeah.
And also, I've been trying to fathom this again for a long time now. Like, who gets through the net and gets the tick box? And who doesn't get through the net gets a big black cross? And I think that's so unfair of me. How am I judging people? And I think what he did, which makes it livable with, is he just, like, he put his mug of tea down and said, oh, right, okay. And he gave himself to that moment. Sounds a bit kind of corny and fluffy, but he was, the last thing he was fluffy. He somehow was able to stay present with whatever I was saying and think about it as a, all right, yeah, so you don't really want it as a shrine then, but you do want, he really tried to make something of this thing that I was sharing with him rather than pushed it away.
Okay. Oh God.
And most other people who'd said to me, oh, I don't want it as a shrine, would you? I'd have been quite offended, even if I didn't want it as a shrine, the changes in the room. He had something about him, and I haven't really nailed what that quality is.
Yeah.
I think it's courage.
Yeah, and I mean, I remember him from talking to you, and that was really playing on my mind, and then I just started writing. That's essentially generated the character of Nathan, who is a builder that comes in and is trying to take down a wall in the room, and this scene just kind of arrived. So that directly affected. The other thing was, you told me in the group about with the Sibs group. The Sibs group, sorry, we should really explain, is a group for the children of the bereaved parents, so the surviving children, so they've lost a sibling. And they also have groups, they go and do fun stuff with Nick. And you were telling me about when they made boxes and how it was really important that they decorate the boxes, make them exactly how they wanted, and they could put whatever they wanted inside. That was another story that really stayed with me. And there's a moment in the play where a child gives Mary a box with a photo in it of her son. And that was another moment. So I kind of afterwards created the landscape, which was a little bit isolating, but it was all these little pockets of moments which came to me first of who's gonna be the person that helps this woman, who's gonna be the person that makes her feel held. In her grief. So all of those actually really jumped out at me first. Mm-hmm. And then I sort of built the rest of the play around it.
And then going back to the kind of builder type character person, it's like often people who step just with their heart and step, you know, just don't run a mile and don't also try to give you any advice. Kind of theory or advice. I think that is one of the things I bristled. I mean, I am a bit touchy, but I bristled with any advice about where I should be feeling or what I should be feeling. I just had an instant rejection because I kind of felt this is about me and Naomi, and you wouldn't be giving me advice about where I send her to school. Well, you might be, and I'd tell you where to go.
So individual as well. You said, yeah, such a just because somebody has also lost a child, it's a similar experience, but it's not the same because it's only your relationship with that person. And I was talking to, I did a little bit more research with a friend of mine, Judith, I'm sure she won't mind me saying, who lost her daughter Emily when Emily was about 18. And she said one of the things that was so isolating she found was the loss of identity and validation that she had from her relationship with her daughter. Every conversation they had, every moment they shared together, alone, you know, nobody else was there to now validate that that existed, it happened, it meant something, and it changed and shaped them both as people. She'd sort of lost that personal relationship with her daughter. And nobody, she couldn't tell any or explain it in a way. It was only known by the two of them. And how difficult that was.
I've just remembered something I wrote, I noted down before we came up. What happens to your relationship with your child when they no longer exist here alongside you? What happens to the relationship? Because it's reciprocal and it's so much about love. So where do you put the love when you can't physically give it to them anymore? And yeah, that's just reminded me what you're saying. And
so bearing in mind all of this fantastically rich conversation the two of you, what was it like seeing the play for the first time?
I was drunk by that point. it was good for me. Obviously I wrote the play, so I'd read it. Nick hadn't read it. It's only the bits which I sort of wanted to check with you, you'd read, wouldn't you? So yeah, I thought the cast did an amazing job. I mean, off the showcase they had about four rehearsals or something ridiculous. The performances were brilliant. I don't know, it's hard to talk about something. I felt quite proud of it, I suppose, just that it had come to fruition in the way and the state, and it was honest. I don't know if it's right, and this is the thing. because everything's so individual, I'm sure there'll be plenty of people that come to watch and go, actually, that wasn't it. That's not how it happens. And we were talking about this yesterday, weren't we, Nicola? There's nothing really you can do about that because you just have to let it go, because really the play is just about writing a play, and it's just about starting a conversation and giving a forum for people to be allowed to talk about grief.
I felt seriously scared, really, really scared. So scared that I've kind of blocked out a lot of it. I was terrified for myself, and I was terrified for the cast, who I really love. That cast, I mean, just, I felt so amazed that they're even willing to take on such subjects. I'm so amazed that you've managed to write this sensitive, you know, just put it out there, and that everyone's agreeing to give it their full 100% heart in that form. So, A, I was scared. B, I was full of admiration. C, I was sitting on the frickin' front row by mistake, because there was no other places.
And I was sitting on the back row.
And I couldn't help it. I was sat right on the front row. But I thought the funny bits were like, wow, that's just so... For me, humour has helped me get through, and I'm not saying this is true for everyone, and it sounds very crass, actually, probably, but...
I do think it does.
So black at times that the humour of that... It's another human thing, isn't it? It's just another way.
It's a universal way of coping with anything difficult. And I think for me directing it, I was so glad there were those moments written in that we could play with, because to present such a topic that still has, like, you know, sort of saying, it's still unthinkable for most people, and therefore it's not talked about. And we wanted to start a conversation, and a way to make it accessible to people is to have elements of humour in, because it immediately makes people relax and go, oh, it's okay to think different things about this, and it's okay to talk about it, because everyone's had a laugh now. Yeah. And you can feel from the first laugh in the play that everyone relaxes. So I think in terms of the form of play as presentation, it's absolutely key to have it in there.
And also, it's like, without kind of going into details about what some conversations I had with other bereaved parents and what we might find funny, there is an element of times when you share. I mean, humour's all about sharing, isn't it? And sharing vulnerability and the bizarreness of the world. And there's one thing that I will share, that on our first Christmas after Naomi died, when I received a few letters from people saying, describing their year's achievements their children's achievements. We called it boast post. I think someone wants it called boast post. I remember just like holding them out at arm's length and binning them, and just wanted to write my own boast post about my year. But, you know, and that was in the teeth of grief.
It's such a modern thing as well, isn't it? Like with Facebook, with everyone presenting, you know, this is our life. This is exactly what it's like. It's perfect. It's brilliant. And that's just not true.
But yeah, I think you're right, that humour, that like we were talking about earlier, having this extraordinarily massive thing and being thrown into this other universe, juxtaposed with these completely trivial day-to-day situations, just leaves itself wide open to moments of comedy. And I quite liked the idea of the audience and Mary being together. Mm. So, you know, she's the one who is making the little comments, and the audience laugh, and then she's not alone in the space, which I really enjoy. Like, that's, I liked that idea. There was also, just on a more technical front, a way of grief is so all-consuming, and I had to find a way to make the play watchable, I suppose, for an audience, and make it something that people... I needed to see them to see Mary as the heroine that she is, and as much as, so I almost had to draw away from the private moments and in the moments where she would be privately grieving, and just have those imagined, although I'm sure everybody would have been doing, and just plant her in at the deep end in these horrible, not horrible, but in these social situations, or situations where a stranger's come into your house and you're going to have to, for however you're feeling, lift up a layer and get on with it. Mm. And I think that always means that within the play she is somebody who comes across as a kind of heroine of the piece, as opposed to people becoming slightly annoyed with her.
Well, the trope of the bereaved mother is not... anyone's favourite character, is it?
Because I don't want it to be a victim. I just don't, that's not how I see it. I don't think that's how it is. And especially talking to you, she does have an incredible amount of strength, that character. I always talk about the characters like they're real. Sorry, but I do sort of like in love with them. but she does hold a lot of power and a lot of strength. Mm. And I wanted the audience to go with her on that journey and see, in spite of this bastard who keeps saying this to me, I'm still here and I'm still trying. I'm still coming to these bloody dinner parties.
I think that was the most wonderful part of watching it. I felt very connected with the mum, not just because I am a mum, but also because she's doing her thing. And like you say, this is never going to be about a right or wrong. It's never going to be like this is the final word on what a bereaved parent feels. Because I've learned now, I'm not as evangelical as I used to be about where I'm going to get with Naomi or how it's... You know, I'm now much more open to the fact the world changes constantly. And you know, as a parent, I thought I was going to be walking ahead of my child, beating down the brambles and making her path. And she overtook me and went to that place where I can't get her. And, you know, I've responded in a certain way and there's going to be a million other responses. And however beautifully your writing is and the cast are humanly put, that's the thing that's important, is that everybody's trying to raise this subject. It's not going to be the right answer, the right perfect, wonderful, you know, imprint of the subject forever. Of course it's not. It's going to just start a conversation, hopefully.
It's just going to be one thing. And my hope is film will come out and I just start talking, really. That's all it's meant to be.
I think the really good thing about the way the play works is that because you're not just looking at Mary as the bereaved mother, you're looking at how she interacts with everyone else and all their experiences of the grief as well. I think there's kind of something there that everyone will be able to relate to, not just bereaved parents, but any audience member will be able to. And that's a conversation I had with lots of people after they'd seen it, was, oh, you know, that one bit where, you know, he said the wrong thing and then he got really, I can recognise that in me and having had that happen. Mm. Or it's really nice to have that universality.
So really good that you've just said that, because about the them and us thing, the ripples in the community, and I've been so shocked since this happened to me, like how many people have either had this happen, or there's someone their family has, or some of their friends have. In every community now, there'll be people who absolutely have been affected by the death of a child, and the ripples are endless. And some, just the fact that people can be reached on many different levels and recognise things, you know, that happened for them, even if they haven't actually, if they are not bereaved themselves in that way. It's got to be good just to have it erased to the surface, you know?
Absolutely. I think there's a thing to say as well, that even we were saying the other day, like, oh, I can still completely fluff it for all the research I've done, for all the writing I've done on the subject. And if I saw somebody who'd just lost somebody, I get nervous, I sweat, I go, oh God, I don't know what to say. And I probably completely fluff it and go, how are you? You know.
Interrupt. I know I keep interrupting on this.
No,
my daughter died 10 years ago and life has resumed. You know, the waters have settled a little, and grief, I think there's a beautiful phrase someone's written somewhere that grief is in a different register, has changed. But I can completely say the wrong thing and someone will tell me who's very newly bereaved, and I can find myself struggling for words or sort of say, oh God, I'm so sorry. And I know for me that worked, but I suddenly think it sounds so crazy. It doesn't work at all to say you're so sorry. You know, when I'm saying it to a bereaved parent, I think, oh God, I'm just not saying the right thing. And that feeling of not knowing what to say still affects me.
Yeah.
Still affects me.
I don't think they'll ever, because there is no right thing. There's nothing you can say. That's the thing.
I mean, again, I've sort of got less ideas about this than I used to have. But the sorry is a very, I think, I would say, acknowledging and saying anything that doesn't try and fix pain is good.
Mm.
Because sharing, even in silence, with a sorry is resounds. It has weight to it, and that's what I wanted to hear. I found people sending texts just knowing that people are thinking of you by text or phone calls can be very tricky because, like you say, you don't always want to raise your game to get up and answer a phone. No. But on your phone, even the slightest phone voice
there is
impossible.
Different manner, you know, to the phone, answering the phone, isn't it?
I think texting is one of the few times in life I think texting and mobile's actually got a place, because sending someone a text saying, "I'm really thinking of you today," and it is very helpful. But there's no, I mean, when the worst things happen to you, there's very little that's going to make it right. Mm. Whatever you try and say, it's going
to
be...
Well, I really, I like the line Mary has where she says right at the beginning to Jack, who's falling to pieces and feels like he's failing to say anything useful, and she just says, "You can't make it worse."
Yeah.
Saying something is better than saying nothing.
Saying something is definitely better than saying nothing. You can chuck salt in it. You can make it feel... You know,
I suppose I was going to say, he does say that, and then they do kind of make it a bit worse, don't they? That those do. Yeah, it's funny. I was talking to someone the other day, and they said it was somebody's birthday who'd passed away, and they said, "Oh, I don't feel as bad, and that makes me feel bad," you know, because they didn't. And we were talking about thinking about it as a wound and having that rawness. And then over time, maybe closes a little bit. But he was saying, "I feel so guilty because I don't feel as bad. And then I feel like, oh, I've lost the connection or somehow," which,
because at first, I felt that if I have a better day, it means I'm less close to Naomi.
Less
so
connected.
That's not good, because I'm obviously kind of getting over it. And that's not okay, because that means she's diminishing and disappearing. Actually, now I feel completely differently to that, I think. Susie Hansen started the slow group with me. She had this wonderful phrase where she just said, "It doesn't get better, but it gets better." And I kind of find this whole grief thing, it's so full of paradox. It's like your child feels unbearably close and unbearably far away.
Yeah.
You know, how can they not exist and yet your life is full of them? It's like, it's all about paradox. So it doesn't get better, but it gets better. It's like, it will never get better, but your life will not be the same as this forever, and your world won't feel as decimated forever.
Mm-hmm.
And the getting betterness is a bit about how you start to navigate the world you now live in, and somehow you put yourself together again somehow, you know, all different.
Yeah.
All different.
Oh, and that's really, I was just going to say, that's you spoke to me about that, about the vase smashing, and then it gets put back together, which... does actually happen in the play with the bowl that they threw back together, which was kind of, again, just derived from that conversation.
Mm.
And she kind of, Jack gives her the bowl, and she's like, "She'd prefer it that way, you know, because it's real, because it's
exactly.
put together and it's got all the holes in it and it's jagged and it's stuck together with tape, but that's the reality of the situation." You kind of rebuild.
That's right, and for me, it's like, I love the word recalibrate. It's like those spirit level things you have to put on wood to make it straight. It's like gradually I felt, okay, I'm recalibrating, I'm sort of adjusting around this, but it can get kind of smashed and all over again at other certain times, but it settles again and finds some place, and it moves again, and it's getting used to that kind of topsy-turvy way of being. But at the end of the day, I'm very much in favour of the fact that it's about courage, courage to be with that pain, you know, that people around us stay with us. And that's the hope for me. It's not that I have a hope I'm going to, you know, ever be really sorted on this. And it's not that I have a hope that I'm going to definitely see Naomi again. I don't have that hope. I have the hope that I can live in this world now. This is the world I live in. And my friends and my family and the wider universe, we all share this world.
So the one last thing I wanted to ask you is sort of in brief, what are your hopes for the play? What do you hope people gain from it? Why is it important? Anything along those lines that you have in your mind?
Again, I just feel... I mean, obviously, I hope as a theatrical experience that people enjoy watching it, and that they enjoy the story, because story is really what it's all about sharing stories. I think theatre's about community, and I feel like... hopefully the play will provide another source of community for people who might have experienced bereavement of any kind, who are supporting somebody who's bereaved, just to give them a forum, almost to give them permission in which to talk about what's happened. So that's my hope for the play, really. That's sort of why I wrote it. I think sharing stories is as old as time. That's kind of why we're here. It's about connection. And if this provides a forum in which people to connect, then that would be my hope.
Yeah, I totally agree with that in terms of connection, that providing any kind of space in which there can be connection is a good thing. And it's, you know, as we've talked a lot, it's a very isolated, solitary place to be in this sort of type of grief. And I think anything that just allows people to air that subject so that they can, if people want to say, actually, that's rubbish, it's not how it was for me at all, or, oh, wow, that was just like, that's healthy and that's fertile and that's alive. Yeah. And I think rather than pushing it away and shunning it and sweeping things under the carpet, you can't with this. And it's, I think bereaved parents, me speaking for myself and some others, just want to feel that there isn't such a stain and such a isolating thing. It's isolating anyway, so to have that space to share, it's really courageous and amazing that you've done it. I mean, it's amazing.
Thank you both very much.
Thanks.
For more information about Slow, you can visit their website at www.slowgroup.co.uk. Staying Alive will be playing at the Pleasance Theatre from November the 10th. Tickets are on sale now at pleasance.co.uk.